flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is November 24th and it's 9:02. And I'm Bill Finley. I'll be your host this morning on the TDN Writers Room. No, Joe Bianca didn't get better looking for some reason. It's really me. Joe's on vacation today. And we're going to have John Green, of course, and a pinch hitter off the bench, who you'll see in just a minute.
Jonathan Green, general manager at DJ Stable. And Bill, speaking of pinch hitters, which made me think of baseball, I now know how Willie Randolph felt in the mid-80s on the Yankees. I am sandwiched between two Hall of Famers, Bill Finley and Randy Moss, just like Willie Randolph was between Ricky Henderson and Dave Winfield.
And I am Randy Moss with NBC Sports and the Buyers Speed Figure Group with the scratch of Joe. I've drawn in from the also eligibles, and I'll just try to keep this thing from crashing on the rocks due to anything I do wrong.
All right. Well, we're very pleased to have Randy. He's been a guest on the pod, Green Group guest of the week on the podcast before, but he comes in with a new role today. I want to remind you that we are brought to you by Keeneland. Mark your calendars for the January Horses of All Ages sale, which begins January 10, 2022. Visit january.keeneland.com to learn more. Well, in what is normally a pretty slow week for racing, we did have some pretty interesting news. And let's start with what I thought was the biggest story of the week, because it involves a huge name and a very major development here. Peter Miller, controversial, yes, but also a very successful trainer in California, is always right up in the top of the standings, especially at Del Mar. He announced last week that he is stepping away from racing. He didn't give a time frame, how long it was going to be. Use the usual words that you get to spend more time with his family, et cetera. Now, there have been rumors all over the place, especially on Twitter, that he's going to go away. Something is about to come down. But all we have right now officially is from Peter Miller, a press release and announcement that he's walking away from the game and his stable will be turned over to his assistant trainer. John, what'd you make of this?
Well, Bill, I thought it was interesting on a couple of high points. Number one is that, you know, Peter Miller has been embroiled with not only a lot of positive tests. And if you go onto a website known as Thoroughbred Regulatory Rulings, you can actually see that he's got 73 positives and infractions since 2005. And that does not include the six horses under his charge that died on the racetrack, died out in California over the past 12 months. So to say that he has been embroiled in controversy is an understatement, because on top of that, he also added fuel to the fire when he was training Stormy Liberal, who, you know, ran in the Breeders' Cup. And at the end of Stormy Liberal's career, also said, I think this horse should retire, then flip-flopped and said, maybe he should run again. Then one of the other owners bought him out, you know, bought the other owner out, and he took sides. And it was just a big cluster out in the news. The thing that you know, really shocked me the most was that he actually came out with a press release saying how he was going to, you know, ride off into the sunset and no longer train. And you wonder why somebody would do that. You wonder, is it that he has a hidden message out there that he's trying to basically keep himself out of harm's way with maybe some additional testing and some, you know, with Heisa and USADA coming down the line on some trainers that have been, you know, less than ethical, you know, to say the least, and he's worried about that? Or is he just really, you know, concerned about his own health and riding off into the sunset and taking the easiest job in the world? And I know from history, and that's being a racing manager, because no matter what the racing manager does, it's never his fault. It's always the trainer's fault that screws up. So I think there's a lot of factors going in as to why he put out that press release. And I think as time, you know, goes on, it'll start to unfold as to really the behind the scenes rationale as to why he thought it was so important to get out in front of the story.
Yeah, I mean, because of the positive tests, because of the horse deaths, he's been under increasing scrutiny from the racetracks in Southern California at which he races, particularly Santa Anita, where he's based. He claims this decision has nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with the recent spate of horse deaths or anything else. As you pointed out, he says he just wants to step away, and he gave himself an out to come back. He said he's sure that at some point, I don't remember the exact quote, but at some point he'll get back into the training business. So it'll be interesting to see if there is anything else that comes down from this over the next weeks or months. I'm guessing it probably won't be, but it's a very interesting development.
Yeah, I think the question is, can you take what he said at face value? And as Randy mentioned, he did mention in his press release that in no way is this related to any pending regulatory problems or, you know, anything else that might be feeding the rumor mill. But I would admit that, I'm not sure I can give him the benefit of the doubt here because, you know, maybe that's unfair. But, you know, if you add it all up, it doesn't really pass the smell test here. And, you know, what it reminds me a little bit of is when Michael Jordan went to play baseball. And they all said that, you know, he's getting out of Dodge before the hammer comes down on his gambling issues. And, you know, again, that was a lot of, you know, scuttlebutt and rumors. And we don't know if that was true or not. But, you know, this is not a guy with three horses and who is just, you know, walking away because he's not making enough money or something like that. And he's also obviously, you know, clearly one of the, you know, trainers, which is the vast majority of all of them, that, you know, works 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And I think that's because, you know, he's conditioned to it. And I don't think that what I'm bringing that up is because I don't think that the grind really gets to them. It's something that they prosper from. So, John, have we heard the last of this story?
No, Bill, there's no question we haven't heard the last of it, because I think as, you know, the testing continues to get more strenuous and USADA and HISA come into play, that all trainers, not just Peter Miller, but all trainers are going to be under much more scrutiny and under a larger microscope. But the takeaway for me from this press release, you know, reminded me again of Shakespeare and the old line of, the lady doth protest too much. And basically, you know, I think that the reason why he put that press release out there was basically to say, you know, hey, I'm going to get out in front of this and say that nothing's wrong and I'm getting out of Dodge before all these, you know, testing conditions come into play because I haven't been, you know, playing with a fair deck for most of the career. And look, it's scuttlebutt and hearsay, but there's a reason why his nickname is Cheater Miller.
And by the way, when you see the form reversals that are epidemic in thoroughbred racing right now, and suddenly trainers batting 40%, it's a good thing that the scrutiny is going to be ramped up with ISA.
Yeah, and I think one of the most, again, if you don't want to give him the benefit of the doubt, if you're saying, hey, you know, this just doesn't add up, I think the thing that was resonated most with me was, and this is reported by the LA Times, since December of 2020, he had six horse deaths. And the next highest among any trainer was three. Now, you know, he's got a lot of horses. He runs more horses than almost all trainers out in California, if not the most. You have to factor that into it. But remember some of the things that Dan Ross in the TDN was writing about, that, you know, the California Horse Racing Board is looking at potentially penalizing trainers for the amount of breakdowns they have if it is an exorbitant amount. And, you know, I know that the room has cooled a little bit and the temperature has gone down, but it's essentially exactly what happened with Gary Hollendorfer at Santa Anita. I believe, as a matter of fact, that it was the exact same amount of deaths over pretty much the same period of time, where they said to him, you know, you got to go. And, you know, controversial move. He's still allowed to run at Del Mar and Los Alamitos, but, you know, it's been a huge hindrance to his career. So we will see. It'll be interesting to see, John. And here's another thing, too. And I'm sorry, I didn't write down the gentleman's name, but the new assistant trainer. The assistant trainer who's now going to take over the stable. Would you expect that, you know, it's going to still be Peter Miller-esque in terms of how many races they win and their winning percentage or not? Or is it going to have a fall off because the boss is gone?
You know, that's the $62 million question, Bill. And you would think that even though Peter Miller is no longer in the shed row, that it sounds like as racing manager, he's still going to have his fingerprints on all of his horses. So I would expect that the win percentage might go down a little bit, but for all intents and purposes, if the assistant trainer has been working with Peter Miller for all of these years, then he's going to utilize the same protocols and the same pre-race you know, medications and therapies that Peter Miller did himself. Again, the nice thing about it from Peter Miller's standpoint is that because he's at arm's length, if a horse comes up with a positive, it's not on him. if a horse, you know, dies, unfortunately, on the racetrack, it's not on him. It's now on some, the burden is now on somebody else. Yet he can still be involved and still, you know, like I said, have his fingerprints on what's going on, you know, in the barn.
Now, Ruben Alvarado is his longtime assistant that's going to be taking over the reins. So it'll be really interesting to see.
Yeah. And it's this is going to take effect at the end of the Del Mar meet, which I believe is November 29th. And then they'll move on back to Los Alamos.
Bill, let me just, I'm going to ask Randy a question because he's so involved in the metrics of the industry. When you mentioned this before, when you see a guy like Peter Miller or any trainer for that matter, who claims a horse, gets a horse, you know, off of another trainer and improves leaps and bounds because of the training methods that they use. What does that do for you as far as trying to calculate, you know, your figures?
As far as calculating figures, it doesn't really have an impact because the figures are just based on the running time of the horse relative to the speed of the racetrack. You know, we don't factor anything else in there, but certainly people use speed figures as a way to ascertain the level of improvement that these horses show when they go from one trainer to another. And as we've seen many times over the course of, you know, 25 years, heck, you go all the way back to Oscar Barrera in New York, if you want to, but we've seen some pretty remarkable improvement from some of these trainers. It naturally causes suspicion. Sometimes it's valid. Maybe sometimes it's not. You could throw a lot of guys under that umbrella. Brad Cox, you could throw, you know, Peter Miller, obviously. A lot of other guys, and I'm not saying that Brad Cox or Peter Miller have definitively done anything wrong or are doing anything wrong. It may be good horsemanship. It may be changing training methods. I don't know. But it definitely raises eyebrows occasionally, yes.
Moving on, another subject that was in the news lately, and I know this is something that Randy has been talking about for a long, long time, is the problem with timing in the sport of thoroughbred racing. The Breeders' Cup, after times first came out, then we know that I believe four races, I was going through the charts and I could only find three races where it said in the charts that the time had been changed or had to be reevaluated afterwards. I believe there was four because I believe the Breeders' Cup Classic also had that same problem where they had to correct the time afterwards. Randy, let me go to Randy first before we go to John. And Randy, just what's going on here? What do you know?
Well, as far as final times at the Breeders' Cup, there were three races in which the final times were changed after the fact. The 2 5 furlong turf sprints, the juvenile turf sprint on Friday, and then the turf sprint on Saturday. And then also on Friday, the juvenile fillies turf had a final time change. For different reasons, the explanations have been a little shaky. It was for the two turf races. It was apparently a surveying / installation problem with GBAX for the other race for the juvenile fillies turf. Somehow the new hybrid beam system, we can talk about that later if you want, that they had employed for the Breeders' Cup was somehow switched to GPS timing, and that race was actually timed by the GMAX GPS. They realized it was inaccurate, which GMAX times tend to be. It was inaccurate by about 72 hundredths of a second, and so they realized the mistake, and they went back to the beam time, which was accurate, and made that official. Fractional times, you mentioned the classic, the fractional times are still at Del Mar calculated through GPS. So they are chronically inaccurate. The Breeders' Cup Classic, for example, the half mile for Nick Sko in 45.77 was about 3/5 of a second too fast, which visuals would almost tell you watching the Breeders' Cup Classic. The distaff with the supersonic early pace was also 2 to 3/5 of a second too fast. It was still extremely fast for those horses. But fractional times throughout the entire Breeders' Cup races are an issue.
John, what do you make of this?
Well, the reason why it's so important, you know, 3/5 of a second, 1/5 of a second here and there, you would normally say, who cares, guys? It's much to do about nothing. But the reason why it's so important is because the bedrock of the industry, you know, are these metrics. And whether it's buyer figures or sheet numbers or Thorograph, or, you know, fill in the blank. It, basically, what the industry was trying to do is figure out a way to compare horses across the United States, or across, including Canada. So theoretically, a horse that ran an 80, I'm going to use buyer numbers, an 80 buyer number in New York would be able to beat a horse that ran a 78 buyer in California, or a horse that, you know, that ran a 77 buyer in Bill's favorite racetrack, Fawner Park. It was a way to kind of level the metrics so that way you can compare all over the place. Why is that important? Well, that's important because people make major decisions on not only where they're going to run horses, but even more importantly, how to value horses across the landscape. So, you know, if the bedrock is broken or shaken because the timing mechanisms are off, then it has a butterfly effect throughout racing, which also has a major impact on breeding. Because now all of a sudden, if I thought a horse of mine, a filly of mine, could, you know, compete in a stake race somewhere, and I'm looking at the metrics and I say, well, no, she really can't. Maybe I should retire her instead. Well, now she's not going to be as valuable as a broodmare prospect because she doesn't have black type. And if she doesn't have black type, then when you go to sell her, she's not worth nearly as much. So it has a tremendous effect, a fifth of a second, three fifths of a second. It almost doesn't matter how much the timing is off. It has a major ripple effect throughout the industry, both industries, racing and breeding, and it needs to be fixed. And you would think that there are a couple of easy solutions for this situation.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah. Here's my take on it, and then I'll throw it to Randy. What's amazing to me is it's 2021 and we seem to be doing a worse job timing races than we did in 1971. How is that possible? And you look at how races in human sports where time is incorporated, which would be track and field and swimming. And I believe that they've got it down to like a millionth of a second or 100,000th of a second or something like that. You never hear about any of this in other avenues where time is of a particular relevance to the competitors and the outcome or whatnot. So, you know, and Randy, you can just pick up what you're getting ready to say before, but, you know, how is this that we literally are going in the wrong direction?
Well, first of all, I hereby nominate you two guys to be in charge of data accuracy in thoroughbred racing from this point going forward. It would have solved a lot of these problems. So we've gone backwards, Bill, since 1941. I mean, you can go back to when beam timing was first instituted by the American Teletimer System in the late 1930s. And from then up until very recently, horse players seldom had to question the accuracy of the final times that they were betting on. So about 3 years ago or so, the genesis of this problem came about when Equibase noticed that a lot of the smaller racetracks in America weren't upgrading, weren't maintenance wasn't done properly on their beam timing systems. And so you were getting a lot of missing times, you were getting a lot of hand times and bad times. And they decided that a newfangled high technology, supposedly GPS system, which was easier to install, which cost less to maintain, and theoretically, according to them, would be just as accurate, would be the way to go. So they bought this system. They began installing it at racetracks across America. They didn't properly vet it. And when it came to their attention, just about a year and a half ago, that these times were not just off by fifths of a second, one fifth, they were off by two fifths, three fifths, four fifths of a second, every day, not just periodically, every single day. And it was brought to their attention about a year and a half ago. Their response, believe it or not, at that time, how accurate is accurate enough? Do we really need that kind of accuracy in thoroughbred racing? These are the people that were in charge of accurate data in thoroughbred racing. They were asking these questions and were sort of poo-pooing it, right? In the meantime, the people who were betting serious money, millions, tens of millions of dollars in total, on races at Del Mar, Woodbine, Tampa Bay Downs, Canterbury, Houston, Laurel for a while, Penn National, Mahoning Valley, those horse players should, if they could see what we have seen with the accuracy of the times, there'd be a revolt. I mean, they should be unbelievably upset about this. I know horse players are used to getting punched in the mouth by racetracks that don't necessarily treat them with the respect that they should. But this has been just horrible. Now, lately, they've recognized the problem. I'll give them credit for that. And they've tried to fix it with this new hybrid beam system. What they've done is at the tracks that have been timed with GPS, they have taken the regular American Teletimer beams, okay, that worked so well for all these years, and retrofitted them to make them RF, to make them transmit signals wirelessly to the grandstand instead of hardwired. It's the same thing track and field does, RF. It is accurate. And so they have been final, they've been using that for final times of races at Del Mar since the closing weekend of the fall meet and now through this meet. And it's been accurate. The final times have been accurate. And they're hoping now to take that to Tampa Bay Downs, which opens today as we tape this on Wednesday. It's still not fully installed at Tampa Bay Downs. Woodbine is going on right now. The times at Woodbine are tragically bad. They're comically bad. So this has got to, you know, this has got to be fixed. Hopefully this hybrid beam system will fix the final times at all these racetracks. But meanwhile, the fractional times are still and will continue to be a problem at these tracks.
John, what do you make of all this?
Well, it's obviously something that needs addressing and needs to be fixed, Bill. There's no question that as we mentioned before, it's got such importance. You know, tens of millions of dollars change hands, not only on the gambling side, but again, on the breeding side and the racing side based on these figures. So, you know, I'm a little bit more optimistic in hearing Randy's explanation as far as what can be done, because it sounds like it's a really simple fix and that the technology is already there. So to me, it's on the racetracks at this point to get their acts together and fix the situation, which again sounds like it's a relatively quote unquote easy fix at this point.
We do need to mention a disclaimer here of sorts. We should mention that former TDN publisher Barry Weisbord operates a competitor to GMAX, and that's Trackus. So just so that everybody's on board with that. Randy, can GMAX be fixed? Can it do what it's supposed to do, which is give accurate times plus a lot of bells and whistles or whatnot? Or is it just did they buy a lemon and it's time to pull the plug on the thing?
That's a great question, Bill. I was actually contacted by a guy from overseas who has been intimately involved with GPS systems in thoroughbred racing at tracks in Australia and elsewhere. He was flabbergasted. You know, he said our GPS can be accurate final time-wise to within centimeters of accuracy. But he said the issue is those GPS systems are prohibitively expensive. And he said, I guarantee you what Equibase and the Jockey Club have done is they've tried to save money by going to a less expensive system. And I was actually told that by Equibase at the very beginning of all this, that there were other GPS systems that were more accurate, but that at this point they're cost prohibitive. And hopefully in the future, they could use some of those at the major racetracks. It's not just final times that we're seeing from GMAX that are problems. All you have to do is look at the GMAX charts that are now being published. If you look at the Breeders' Cup Turf, the biggest turf race in America, you look at the first couple of points of call that they have in their charts, 16th of a mile, 8th of a mile, it's unbelievable. They've got a horse that was 9th in 2nd. The horse that they've got in their charts that was 3rd was somewhere in mid-pack. I mean, it's not even close. So, in my opinion, the whole system is inaccurate. And I mean, if it can't come within 30 or 40 feet accuracy and final times, how can you ever expect it to be accurate in such a precise manner that it can measure average stride length? Okay. Maybe they can get it fixed. Hopefully they can, but it doesn't look good right now.
Right. And I just want to add to the conversation. One thing I will say in Equibase's favor is Sal Sinatra, who was on the show
yes.
a while back running on the Maryland Racing, has been hired to be the new president of Equibase. And, you know, I don't know if he's got any magic wands that can fix this overnight, but I think I know John and I, and I maybe I'm speaking for Randy, but I bet you he has a lot of confidence and respect for Saul Sinatra, because, you know, he gets it. He's has been a better at times in his life. So he understands how important this is. So if you can, I don't think you can find a better person to come in and roll up their sleeves and get this fixed, John.
Yeah, no, Sal's impressed us not only, you know, when he went up through the ranks at Monmouth and also at Laurel, but he basically, you know, came in with a game plan at the, you know, for the Stronach race tracks and said, we're not going to accept anything other than the best, and threw out a lot of employees and threw out some trainers that had, you know, questionable resumes, and kind of cleaned that whole system up to the best of his ability. And now hopefully he'll take that new sheriff in town kind of attitude to Equibase as well.
It's a great irony here, guys, that when Sal Sinatra was at Laurel, that was an early installation of GMAX, and the final times, the official final times at Laurel, were switched from their American Teletimer beams to GMAX. And while Sal was there, just before he left to take the president's job at Equibase, he saw how bad the GMAX times were. He pulled the plug on GMAX as an official final timer at Laurel and reinstituted the beam timing system. I'll say, I agree with you guys. If Sal is given proper autonomy by the Jockey Club to tackle this problem, whatever money it takes, and that includes the autonomy to eventually say this whole thing needs to be scrapped until the point of time in which the technology improves. If he's given that autonomy, it can be fixed. But it certainly looks to me like the Jockey Club has sunk a lot of money into this, and right now they seem to be loath to admit that they have a major problem.
Absolutely. Hey, before we go to break, lots going on at Keeneland, one of our sponsors. And John, you were obviously paying a lot of attention to the Keeneland November sale. Tell us what we learned.
Well, we learned a couple of things. Number one is that by any metric, the horse industry is robust when it comes to buying and selling horses. The R&A rate was down almost by 50%, Bill, from year to year. And the Keeneland November broke the record, the previous record of gross sales, you know, I think it was halfway through this past November sale. So, you know, the metrics all show that the market is up. I can tell you anecdotally that I had a list of almost 70 broodmares that we were going to bid on, that I was bidding on from home. And when I tell you I bid on a handful of them, I'm probably exaggerating. The market was strong. People feel like that there was good value in the horses. And because the foal crop has been down every year, those precious few really, really good horses are selling through the roof, and everyone else is scrambling for the middle market. So kudos to Keeneland for not only giving everybody a tremendous, tremendous venue to buy and sell horses, but I understand that that they improved, you know, little things like signage and customer service to make it easier and better for people to have a better understanding of what was going on. They had free food and some drinks and discounted beer day on the last day for the horses of racing age sale. And then they also improved their technology and made it a much better platform to bid online, to the point where every time we were going to bid online, there were three or four other people who were also bidding online that would beat us to the punch to bid on some horses. So hats off to Keeneland. They really upped their game for this past November sale. And I can't wait to see what's going to happen for the January sale.
Seven horses sold for more than $1 million at the Keeneland November, led by Grade One winner Paris Lights, who brought $3.1 million to spend through a farm. Now, John, you guys were directly involved. You sold a bunch of horses in the Horses of Racing Age sale. How'd that go?
It went really well. You know, we were pleased again with not only the platform that they offered online, but also the fact that Keeneland this year, and you've heard me talk about it before, they actually reconfigured their sales calendar. And Randy, you'll appreciate this. What used to happen is at the end of each day at Keeneland for the November sale, they would have about 20 or 25 horses of racing age that would sell that day. And instead, they shifted gears and they consolidated all of the horses of racing age to one day at the very end of the sale. And that's why we entered half a dozen horses in that sale, because it allowed trainers and also the agents alike to come down for that one particular day to bid on horses of racing age. And again, their RNA percentage was you know, so small, it was almost insignificant. There was such a high turnover rate of horses going through the ring and then coming out with a new owner on the other end.
We will be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Respect the law. He's earned it. A grade one winning juvenile.
Tis the law, pops the cork in the champagne.
A classic winning three-year-old.
Tis the law is gonna win the first leg of the Triple Crown.
Five triple-digit buyers.
Respect the law, tis the law.
The best son of Red Hot Sire Constitution.
He's left the others behind. He's gonna win the run, Happy Travers.
Tis the law.
The TDM Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. John, a lot going on with Coolmore as usual. What's in the news with our friends at Coolmore?
Well, right now, after the November sale, the big November sales are over, everyone's scrambling for seasons. And Bill, actually, as we talk, I'm getting emails from Coolmore with regard to some of our matings for the upcoming year. American Pharoah, Caravaggio, Cupid, Motown, Justify, and of course, Mendelssohn are all on our personal docket as far as stallions that we're breeding to this year. And it's only because I couldn't get into Munnings. I didn't have, you know, good enough mares to get into Munnings this year, apparently. So kudos to Coolmore and their team, because they must be getting inundated with season requests for some of their stallions. I appreciate the ones we got. And Bill, we're actually going to be doing a foal share this year to Uncle Mo, which is you know, a real credit, I think, to our program, if I can kind of pat ourselves on the back. But we've never had the opportunity to do a foal share to a stallion like Uncle Mo this year.
So here's more news out of Coolmore from this week. First Crop Sire Classic Empire made headlines on Sunday with Classy Edition, a TDN Rising Star, who's now 3-for-3 after her second straight stakes win in the Keysense Stakes at Aqueduct. Earlier last week, he also had Rocket Dog win on debut at Churchill Downs and Sacred Beauty breaking her maiden at Golden Gate. Another First Crop Sire at Ashford, who was actually ahead of Classic Empire in terms of winners, is Cupid. He's now the sire of 20 winners after adding three new winners this past weekend with Social Engagement at Churchill Downs on Saturday, then Princess of the North at Woodbine and Sterling Silver at Aqueduct on Sunday. And we just mentioned those two stallions, but you look at the TDN Freshman Sires list, you'll see all four of their First Crop stallions, Caravaggio, Practical Joke, Classic Empire, and Cupid, all make the top 10. So there's some very promising young stallions at Ashford. All right, moving on, and let's tackle what's going on in New York. And the story broke last week, and it's something that we've seen before, most notably in Pennsylvania. But two members of the New York State Legislature introduced a bill that, for all practical purposes, takes away all the casino slot money from New York racing, $230 million a year. It was backed by several major animal rights groups, including PETA. And what would happen if this were to come would be that the purses at NYRA would fall precipitously. About 37% of the total money that comes in for purses comes from slots. And you could basically say goodbye to the entire harness industry and the probably Finger Lakes too. I don't know if they could survive something like this. You know, everybody tells me there's nothing to worry about here, that this is never going to go anywhere. But John, I've got a lot of thoughts about this. And one of which is, you know, if these things keep happening, as I said, the governor of Pennsylvania has twice introduced in his budget, taking all the money away from racing and putting it into college scholarships for Pennsylvania citizens. How long can racing fight this off? It's very scary to think that even if, you know, this has a 1% chance of becoming a law or 2% chance that, you know, something like this is actually out there.
Well, and Bill, you mentioned a very good comparable, and that is our neighbor, Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania governor has tried on a couple of different occasions to go ahead and pull monies and use it for, you know, for college and for orphans and for, you know, all kinds of other heartfelt, important groups that do need the help, but also are, you know, really political pawns in the grand scheme of things. And I think it makes headlines. And I think that after a while, they see that the respective lobbying groups push back just as hard, and they show that that there's, you know, billions of dollars of revenue that would get lost if it impacts, you know, racing in New York, and tens of thousands of jobs would be lost, and real estate values would go down. And they do all kinds of studies, and they go back and forth, and it ends up eventually, you know, it's a negotiation and it gets walked back. So do I think that this has a chance to go through? I mean, it always has a chance to go through. But I think, like anything else, it's just all part of the political machine that's out there. And this is low hanging fruit. I mean, what's easier than to try to take money away from an industry that just a couple of years ago was in such disarray that horses were dying on a regular basis, that they were showing, you know, cruel and inhumane situations, that horses were being sent in canisters to, you know, third world countries and islands. And I mean, it's just easy for a lot of politics to be involved and to basically, and rightfully so for a long time, pee on our Cheerios, for lack of a better term. But I think that, like anything else, it'll get walked back. The key component in all this is that I'm confident that it'll get walked back for the simple reason that New York has a much stronger relationship with Albany, and New York Racing, I should say, has a much stronger relationship with Albany and with Washington, D.C. than even Pennsylvania did with their respective powers that be. So I really feel like that it's much to do about nothing, but only because we have a strong lobbying group that shows the economic impact if thoroughbred racing and standardbred racing is either eliminated or somewhat reduced in the Empire State.
Well, hopefully they do have enough lobbying and legislative clout to fend this off. But it just goes to illustrate what we've all known for a long time, that there is a double-edged sword to the marriage of casino gaming and thoroughbred racing. Even at those racetracks that managed to get casino gaming under the guise of saving horse racing, right? Tracks that might have been defunct and now brought back, like Prairie Meadows, for example, that the marriage of casino and horse racing was to save the sport of horse racing and protect all those dollars. The problem always becomes then, or something racing needs to guard against for sure, is that when the state legislature sees how much money these casinos are making and that horse racing continues to be a loss leader, and horse racing is not nearly as productive financially as the casino that's adjacent to it, then it becomes, as you said, it becomes low-hanging fruit for the legislator to say, wait a second. You know, why are we subsidizing horse racing by taking this casino money that could be used for schools, that could be used for infrastructure and things like that? That's not fair to the state, especially as states get more and more financially strapped. So that's something that racing has obviously had to guard against for a long time. And now that you've got the animal rights aspect of this as well, then that makes it even more imperative for racing to keep its guard up there.
And this isn't something that original thought, but a couple things. It shows how important it is to drive up handle. They can't ever take the handle money away from us. So, and racing is having a good year when it comes to that, so far as the numbers being up for the total amount bet. But, you know, I'll sort of mirror what you guys said earlier. I think, you know, how many times do you dodge a bullet here? And sooner or later, one of these efforts is going to work, because people become more and more enamored with animals all the time, it seems. You know, the society's take on animals is much different than it was 30, 40 years ago. And, you know, horse racing does have a lot to answer for. It has to answer for the breakdowns, and not as much now as it did maybe 15, 20 years ago, but the horses sent to slaughter. So I think what is interesting here also is the fact that this just isn't two kind of lone wolf legislators that, I mean, they had a who's who of animal rights groups that were backing this. And it'll be interesting to me. I mean, I hope this just all goes away and we never hear word one about this again. But, you know, what kind of lobbying effort is going to happen here with those animal rights groups that I'm sure have a lot of money and a lot of clout, John?
Well, I think, Bill, it goes to show exactly why the NTRA ended up moving their headquarters to Washington, D.C., and you know, hired a new president who basically understands the rules and the ways of the world when it comes to politics. It's this situation, I think, will eventually go away, but it's not going to go away by magic or just by wishing it away. It's going to go away because you have to fight fire with fire, and you have to have a strong lobbying group to be able to show the impact and the importance of thoroughbred racing in the United States, and in this case, in within the borders of the Empire State, New York. But you have to have a strong lobbying presence locally and nationally in order to make sure that we're not wiped off the map.
All right, let's change gears now. Let's talk about Eclipse Award races. And most of them are kind of no-brainers this year. You know, you've got Nick's Go, obviously, is going to be Horse of the Year, and older male champion, et cetera. Latrusco will be older female champion. But there is
Gamine. Don't forget about Gamine, Bill.
And yes, okay, absolutely, Gamine, who's going to be champion sprinter, champion female sprinter, champion steeplechase horse, and
and apprentice jockey.
Right. But there is one very interesting race this year that is very controversial. And the three-year-old Eclipse Award, probably there's three candidates, Essential Quality, Life is Good, and Medina Spirit. The Medina Spirit and Essential Quality are the top two. I don't think Life is Good is going to get all that many votes, though I could certainly understand why people would vote for him. But I'll start with Randy Moss, because he's kind of taking the contrarian view here, as I understand. I'm voting for Essential Quality. I don't believe John has a vote, but if he did, I'm not sure exactly what he would do. But Randy, you know, this is no ordinary Eclipse race. You have a horse who tested positive for the biggest win of his career. And presumably at some point in time, knowing how these things work their way through the courts, probably 5-6 years from now, he is not going to be the official winner of the Kentucky Derby. But I understand you're going to vote for Medina Spirit. Tell us why.
Well, it depends. It depends, Bill. And it's a bit of a paradox here. It's a conundrum, as they say. If, in my opinion, if the Kentucky Derby outcome was not tainted in any way by the betamethasone positive, and you have Medina Spirit winning the Derby, and then Medina Spirit outrunning Essential Quality with a worse trip, by the way, in the Breeders' Cup Classic, then I think Medina Spirit would deserve to be the three-year-old champion. But, of course, you do have the Kentucky Derby issue. So, you know, I don't think at all that any animosity, any hard feelings toward Bob Baffert should enter into the minds of the Eclipse Award voters. I'm afraid it will. I think Essential Quality will be the three-year-old champion. I think that will be more than a small reason why, because I do think there's some blowback there. A lot of people have a negative opinion right now of Baffert, but I don't think that should be part of the equation at all. If the Kentucky Horse Racing Commission rules before my vote goes in to officially disqualify Medina Spirit from the Kentucky Derby, my vote will be for Essential Quality. If it comes time to place my vote and there is still not an official ruling, and as of that moment, Medina Spirit is still the winner of the Kentucky Derby, then I'm going to play it by the book, and I'm going to vote Medina Spirit for champion three-year-old. Because who knows what's going to happen legally down the road. You know, you could vote for Essential Quality on the basis of, you know, the fact or the your opinion that Medina Spirit will almost certainly be disqualified. And nowadays, who the heck knows? The Kentucky Horse Racing Commission might say, all right, we're going to suspend Baffert for 30 days, but 21 picograms of betamethasone that we have now proven was applied topically means that he should not be disqualified from winning. So we're going to leave him as the winner of the Derby. And then it goes into court for other reasons as well. But that's my take on it.
John, do you agree?
You know, Randy, I think that you hit on a very important point, which is in a vacuum, without the Baffert nonsense going on and you know, people being concerned about, you know, what his future is and ultimately what the Kentucky Derby event will show with regard to the legal proceedings. I think if you just took you know, the horse's name off of its past performances and took the trainers and the owner's name and the breeding off of it, you would say Medina Spirit has a very good chance to, on the facts of his racing career, to be 3-year-old of the year. Unfortunately, it's not the case because we're human and we're going to take into consideration, like you said, that Bob Baffert trained the horse. And we're also going to take into consideration that a lot of people who were voting also have financial ties to farms in Kentucky. And no offense to Medina Spirit's breeding, but in comparison to his breeding and where he stands, in comparison to where Essential Quality stands and his, you know, the fact he's the son of Tappet out of Elusive Quality Mare, it does affect the way people vote. Now, you can also say that Medina Spirit, aside from the fact that, you know, he'll likely be disqualified from the most important 3-year-old race of the year, he ran a bad third in the Preakness. And then it was like radio silence. We didn't see or hear or know of Medina Spirit for months, almost until the end of the 3-year-old season was over. And then he came back and ran in a lackluster $100,000 stake race and he won it. And then he ran in the Awesome Again, which even though it was a grade one, I would argue that it wasn't really a legitimate grade one in there, because the two horses that he beat, Stiletto Bay and Express Train, were 20 and 30 to 1 early morning lines, respectively, in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I just don't think that he necessarily represents the best 3-year-old of the year. Now, I don't have a vote. I don't have a vote and I don't have a dog in the fight. But I would also argue that Life is Good should be a serious consideration, being that, you know, he in his 3-year-old campaign, he ran 4 times, which isn't a lot, but he won 3 of them. And the 1 second place that he ran was second to Jackie's Warrior, who argued going 7/8. And arguably, you know, Jackie's Warrior was the best 3-year-old sprinter in the country for a majority of the year. So I could also make that case, as you could also make a puncher's case for Hot Rod Charlie, who seems to be, you know, forgotten in a lot of these head to head, you know, comparables. All the horse did was, you know, ran third and lost by a length in the Derby, lost by a length in the Belmont, and then hit the wire first in the Haskell, even though he was DQ'd, and then won the Pennsylvania Derby. And yeah, he ran fourth, kind of a lackluster fourth in the Breeders' Cup Classic against older horses. But, you know, he should still get some consideration. I think ultimately it's going to come down to Essential Quality is going to win for a lot of the reasons that we talked about. But what's nice is that going through the Kentucky Derby campaign myself this year, we kept talking about how deep of a field the 3-year-olds were this year. And I think it's really come to fruition because we're not even talking about a couple of the other ones, you know, that are running like Midnight Bourbon, that's running in the Clark this weekend. And all he did was run second, third, you know, in a majority of these races, too. So this is a deep class. And it's great that we're having this discussion/argument.
Yeah, my take is sort of similar to that. And Randy, I'll give Medina Spirit credit for winning the Kentucky Derby, because, again, just like you, as long as he is still has not been officially disqualified by the time the votes are in. But even doing so, I still think Essential Quality deserves it. And for the reasons, John, he had the more complete year. He was there from day one through all the, you know, the Derby, the Belmont, the Travers, ran well and won the Jim Dandy, et cetera. Whereas, like John said, you know, we saw Medina Spirit in fits and starts. You know, he didn't really do all that much in the Triple Crown preps, and he comes and wins the Derby, doesn't run all that well in the Preakness, and then comes back again in the Awesome Again, which was not that good of a race. And I realized that he finished ahead of Essential Quality in the Breeders' Cup Classic, but I tend to only give horses credit when they win. I mean, what if one was 7th and the other was 8th? I mean, would you make that case? So, you know, Randy, you're convinced that head-to-head, forget about Baffert, forget about, you never heard of Betamethasone. Never even came across anyone's radar screen that Essential Quality shouldn't get it over Medina Spirit.
Well, I am convinced that head-to-head, that Medina Spirit has more determination than Essential Quality does, and that Medina Spirit would beat Essential Quality 2 times out of 3 when they ran against each other head to head. After seeing the Breeders' Cup Classic, I'm now convinced of that. But yeah, what's interesting here also, it's not apples to apples directly, but there are some valid comparisons to Maximum Security before we knew any of the stuff with Jason Service, right? Officially. Because he wins the Kentucky Derby, was disqualified, but people still viewed that Kentucky Derby as being, when it came time to vote for champion 3-year-old, really as being maximum qualities, right? Or I mean, maximum securities. So we kind of have the same thing here in a way. I mean, 21 picograms of betamethasone, 21 trillionths of a gram on a 1,100 pound horse is not going to have any difference whatsoever in the way he ran in the Kentucky Derby. So the horse, just looking at the horse himself, was definitely unlucky to be disqualified. He's really the victim in this. And I think that, you know, in my opinion, if he is not disqualified, as you pointed out, officially by the time the vote comes in, I think he's a better horse than Essential Quality. But I don't think he'll win.
I don't think he will either. I think Essential Quality will get it. And I'll add, I think Max, I don't remember who the main competitors were for Maximum Security, but when he won the three-year-old championship, I don't think there was a competitor, not least that I recall, that had the kind of credentials that Essential Quality has. So I think, you know, that's a little bit not of an apples to apples comparison. Hey, by the way, we want to let you know that the TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. Handicap and watch live racing like never before. XBTV has exclusive handicapping insights and analysis, picks, morning workouts, interviews, and race replays. Each week, we like to give you the workout of the week. And speaking of horses that is still alive in the Eclipse Award race, that's Dr. Scheibel, who may or may not be named champion sprinter this year. And he is the workout of the week. This week's workout of the week is Dr. Scheibel, who went 3 furlongs in 37.40 at Santa Anita on Monday. Dr. Scheibel was last seen running second to Aloha West in the Grade 1 Breeders' Cup Sprint. Before that, he was undefeated in his last 5 starts, including the Grade 1 Bing Crosby and the Grade 2 Santa Anita Sprint Championship this year. He's among the probables for the Grade 1 Malibu on December 26th. And that is the latest from XBTV. It's now time for the Green Group Guest of the Week. And the Green Group Guest of the Week this week is Anna Ford, the Program Director of New Locations. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by the Green Group, an accounting and tax consulting advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you out at www.greenco.com. Welcome, Anna, and let's right away get into the news that was announced earlier this week. An exciting new initiative with New Locations has something to do with our friend John Green as well.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me. And yes, we are launching our first Giving Tuesday campaign. And John and the Green Family Foundation has put up a $25,000 match to add to our campaign, which is a huge addition. And we're really excited about it because first, it's our first annual Giving Tuesday campaign. And then to have John and his family step up and make this match is really going to just boost the whole campaign. And hopefully we can raise $50,000 or more.
John, I'll jump in there if you would. What made you and your father and the whole Green family come up with this idea?
Well, you know, certainly we've been in the business for almost 4 decades. And during that time, our operation has evolved to the point where it's gotten bigger. And quite frankly, it's not a situation anymore where if we didn't want a horse, you know, to race for us anymore, we'd put it in a claiming race and somebody else would have the opportunity to run it. Now it's gotten bigger. It's gotten more important for us to make sure that horses that we have, once they're done racing, have a good home. And we feel like, you know, Bill and that the most important thing we can do as owners is recognize our responsibility. And when we raise our hand at an auction and buy a horse, or we decide to breed a horse and fill it out and have it run in our colors, it's our responsibility to ensure that those horses are cared for once their racing careers are over. And at least until the point where we can hand it off to somebody else who, again, will take that pledge and take that honor of making sure that that horse is taken care of to the best of their abilities.
Anna, well, let's move on to other subjects. And we're just coming off the Breeders' Cup. And I know that the funds that come in from the Breeders' Cup to the owners, the purse money that comes in is also something that's integral to the success of New Vocations. Tell us more.
Yeah. So, you know, the Breeders' Cup pledge, we founded that 12 years ago. This was our 12th year. And it's, you know, one of the hardest things for us to do is the fundraising portion. I always say that, you know, working with the horses is the easier part, but it's always a challenge to make sure that we can raise enough funds to do, you know, provide all these services that we do every year. And so the Breeders' Cup Pledge was developed as a very simple concept and something that we felt anyone who was going to be running in the Breeders' Cup would be very excited to be a part of. And it's really grown over the years. I know our first year we raised like around 40,000, which back then was really big for us. And the nice thing about this fundraiser is that there's no overhead. So, you know, a lot of times when you do a gala or a fundraiser, you know, you have a rather large overhead. So you raise maybe, you spend 200,000 to raise 300,000 or something like that. And it's like, we've never wanted to have that concept with New Vocations. And so this was perfect because 100% of the proceeds go to the program. And so the last couple years, it's really grown. This year we had 60 horses running. I think you guys would probably know better than me, but I think there's like 160 runners over the 2 days in the Breeders' Cup races. And so, you know, we had 60 of them that had owners and or trainers that had pledged a percentage of their earnings. And so this year we ended up having 8 horses win, which was huge. And we're already at just over 140,000 raised from those pledges. And the great thing that we've seen, well, there's many great things about the pledge, but, you know, we've seen people who have made a pledge and they don't even hit the board and they still donate. So I feel like our pledge will continue to, you know, by the end of the year, we'll see, have a better idea of how much, you know, we're going to raise. But it's been a great concept. Owners tend to really enjoy it. The ones that have, we get a lot of repeat owners who come back, you know, every time they have a horse, now they're actually contacting me before I can contact them, which is great. So it's just a win-win situation and been a great fundraiser for us.
And Anna, give our audience an idea of what happens when somebody donates a horse to you guys, to your organization. You know, what's the protocol? What are you looking to do with the horse? And then ultimately, how do you repurpose it?
So the majority of the horses that are coming to us are coming directly from the racetrack or a layup facility or training facility. And so we're normally contacted either by a racing manager or owner themselves or a trainer. And that, you know, for whatever reason, I mean, the number one reason we get a horse is due to some type of injury, whether it's a minor muscle strain or just a horse that's, you know, not coping well at the track, to, you know, injuries that need to have surgery. And so, you know, we take in the whole gamut. And so once the horse, once we get information on the horse comes into our program. We have locations in New York, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Ohio, Louisiana, and soon to be Florida. And so we will see where the horse is going to best fit. Normally, whichever facility is the closest to that horse is where that horse will go. And then once the horse comes into the program, our team, which includes like our staff, our barn team, our trainers, as well as our veterinarians, will assess, you know, what does that horse need to get prepared for its next career. And so, you know, those horses that have injuries, we'll rehab them. If they need a surgery, we'll provide the surgery and then rehab them. If they just need a little let down time, we'll do that. If they're fairly a sound horse, then, you know, we'll start working with them within a couple weeks and providing them with some transitional training. We call it transitional training versus retraining because the horses already are broke to ride, but the type of training that they're receiving to get them prepared to be a racehorse is very different than the type of training that they need to be a riding horse. And so that's what our team really steps up and gives them that transitional training, and we'll assess, you know, how are they mentally, what can they mentally handle in the second career? How are they doing physically? What can they physically handle in a second career? And then once they have that assessment of, you know, wow, this horse is, you know, a great mover, great mind. It could be a great hunter or jumper, or maybe it's a horse that can't do jumping, but it could be a trail horse. Once they assess what that horse is best going to be suited for, then we put them up for adoption and start screening adopters to find the right home and the right match for that horse.
And back 20, 30 years ago, you didn't hear these sort of things. It was kind of a dirty little secret in the horse industry, what was going on. You didn't have people like the Greens stepping up and doing what they did. You didn't have dozens of owners and trainers pledging money for the Breeders' Cup. How much has the attitude shifted in horse racing? And, you know, what do you think caused that? That, you know, now we're doing, for lack of a better term, a lot better job of doing the right thing.
Right. No, there's been a huge shift. You know, we're getting ready to celebrate our 30-year anniversary next year for new locations. And so, you know, from when you look back that far, we had to go to the track, pick the horse up, bring the horse home, do everything. And I remember when we were about 7 years in and we changed it because there were so many people wanting to utilize, send their horses to us. We said, okay, you're going to have to deliver, like ship the horses to us. And when we made that shift, I'll never forget, because people were like, what do you mean? I'm giving you the horse. Now I got to deliver it to you too, you know? And we're like, yep, you're going to have to do that. And that's just kind of how we were managing our numbers. It's like, okay, well, we're going to help the ones that will actually help us a little bit too. And so, you know, that was like a baby step, right? And then it really was a matter of awareness. And I always felt like it was around 2009, 2010, when you look at when social media really like started up and started up strong, whatever people think about the different platforms and what they do, one thing that Facebook specifically did for the racing industry is raise awareness on that horses could end up in bad places when they're retired from the racetrack. And, you know, that spread way faster than those random stories here and there that might end up in a publication. But even back then, the publications, you know, you didn't hear too many stories about, you know, kill pens or slaughter or anything like that. It was just really around 2009 when, you know, I think it was more social media. So it was awareness. And, you know, I really truly feel like more owners, even back then, truly did and do care about what happens to their horses when they're racing and when they're done racing. It's just that they had no idea that there were bad things happening to their horses when they retired. And so once that awareness, you know, started coming light and you started seeing whether it was true or not, these, you know, Facebook images, that raised everybody's awareness of, wait, I need to start asking some questions. And so that's really where you saw that shift around 2009, 2010, at least that's when we saw it. And more people started wanting to send us horses. More people wanted to fund our efforts because they saw the value in our efforts. So I really feel like it was that raising awareness and getting people educated on what was going on.
And Anna, you guys have done a phenomenal job of getting horses into the right hands and making sure that they have second careers, and that horses get to be horses. They get to enjoy the second half of their lives. And New Vocations, we understand, is the largest and most successful rescue group in the country. You guys adopted out 600 horses last year, which is really incredible. Are there any specific horses that come to mind that are memorable to you? Where, you know, this horse was really extraordinary, or really super smart, or really cute, or in a bad place. I mean, what comes to mind when you think of a horse or two over the past year?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple that stand out in mind. One of them I always talk about is a horse named Sam P, who actually raced in the Kentucky Derby. And he ended up coming through our program. And I think that was a good example of, you know, when you see these horses running in the Derby, you don't think that they're ever going to need a second career. They're all going to go stand at stud or retire at their owner's home or something. But he was a perfect example of a horse that, you know, ended up racing and kind of going through the ranks, and then he had a tendon injury and then needed to retire and needed a home. And he ended up going on to be a pretty successful dressage mount. That one really stands out to me because I know when we got him, we were pretty excited to be like, wow, because, you know, I always like to say, you know, old friends gets all the famous horses and we get the rest. To us, you know, when we get a Derby horse that ran in the Derby or the Breeders' Cup, it's a big deal. And so it was cool to see, you know, his transformation for sure. And then we've got one right now in our barn that I'm not going to mention his name yet because we haven't really put much information out there, but he stands out right now just because his owner had been, his breeder had sold him as a yearling and had been trying to track him. And for a year she had lost track of him. And she ended up finding him about ready to, I don't know if he's going to Puerto Rico or somewhere in the Caribbean, but was able to track him down and paid, you know, $15,000 just to buy him back. And then he was got a direct trip to New Vocations to retire. And that gelding, he's in our barn right now. And, you know, he's an American Pharaoh, son of American Pharaoh, and very, very, very well bred. And he's, you know, now he's going to have a really great, you know, great life. We don't know what it was, you know, when they leave the country, it's hard to know what happens there. But he's one that we're definitely going to be following because his breeder really tried to track him and do the right thing and got him into a good situation.
And another way New Vocations raises money is to have people sponsor stalls at your facility. And that's something that's near and dear to the heart of everybody at the TDN, because the late Ben Massam, who was such a big part of the TDN, the news and features editor, who unfortunately passed away tragically too young, TDN has taken out a stall in his name since then. So tell us more about that program, and how people can get involved that way.
Absolutely. So our facility in Lexington, we built it from the ground up at Merriworth Farm. And to do that, we started a capital campaign in 2016. And so part of that capital campaign is that the stalls, that we have 30 stalls there, they can be sponsored. And so for $10,000 sponsorship, we place a plaque of the person, whatever you want on the on the plaque, which for Ben, they did in memory of Ben Massam. And then that will be their stall for 10 years time, which is really cool. We've got several like that. Rick Violette, NYFA did a stall for him as well. And Paul Saylor's daughter, Olivia Saylor, when she passed away, he did a stall for her. And it's really, you know, I always say those stalls that are in people's memory, when I walk through the barn, always mean a lot, you know. And so it's been fun to the TDN up to date on who's been in Ben's stall, and Ben's parents came out to the farm and got to see his stall and visit the horse that was in there. And so, yeah, it's a really great way to, you know, support our efforts and then follow along with what horses are in those stalls on a daily, if not, you know, how many in a year's basis.
Right. And Bill, just so you know, we've actually had 7 or 8 of our horses over the past 16, 18 months go through New Vocations as well. And I was going through the list the other day, and you know, it was horses that basically, you know, weren't able to make it on the races or had an injury. And I know that I can sleep soundly that all of them have been rehabilitated and are now, you know, probably in better phases of their lives, whether it's trail riding or dressage or what have you. But it makes us feel good knowing that the horses are getting a, you know, another chance and getting loved and getting the opportunity to live out their lives in a happy place. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that any donations that go to New Vocations, which is a 501c3, any donation is a tax deduction. So not only are you doing something good for the industry and good for the horse specifically, but it also benefits you as well, you know, for your tax returns. So just remember that, because it is a 501c3, it is a tax deduction for you as well. And Anna, one of the things that I enjoy about what you guys do is when we do donate a horse, we get constant updates on those horses, not only when they arrive, but also as they're going through the rehabilitation program. And it's great to see, because when I look at the first picture that I see versus the last picture before they go off to their next place, it's like they've gone to a spa. They look healthier, they gain weight. So what is the protocol for you guys when you get a horse? Is it, and you know that it's sound enough to start going into its second career, is it a lot more feed? Is it, you know, a lot more extra rubbing? Like what do you guys do to make them look so good before they go off?
Well, they look pretty good at the track, but obviously you don't normally see fat horses running around the racetrack, or at least not very quickly. So when they come in, you know, they're just all muscle. They're so fit. And so there's just our goal is that while they lose that muscle because they're not going to be in that high intense training, that we help them gain weight at the same rate that they're losing that muscle. And that's a challenge because, you know, in general, the thoroughbreds have a very high metabolism. So, but it is our goal to try to make that balance so that they don't just, if you don't try to make sure they're gaining weight, they'll just really shrink. And some of them do that anyhow, and then they bloom. But yeah, the before and after pictures are pretty amazing. And, you know, they're not under the same amount of work, so it's easier for them to gain weight. It does take, you know, a couple months, sometimes several months to get them to that shape. It's not easy and it's not quick. But I will say normally the photos that you're getting that we put up on the website, they actually had a spa day. So when they arrive from the track, like we didn't brush them up for the pictures. Kind of like here, it's our, we call it inventory picture. Here's they arrived. So we can document all of that. But there definitely is a big transformation there for sure.
Anna, before we let you go, could you just give out the website and in particularly how people can get involved in the John Green DJ Stable Giving Tuesday program?
Absolutely. So our website is newvocations.org, and the Giving Tuesday information is on there. You can either go to donate or to the news page, both ways you can access that. We'll be doing a lot of different, you know, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We love to have people follow and share our information, especially over the next 7 days while we're doing the campaign. Because the more, you know, even if you can't make a contribution, if you can help us spread the word, that really makes a huge difference. And so we appreciate all of that as well. So it's newvocations.org, and yeah, click on donate.
And spend our money. We want you to spend our money. The point of this is to make sure, because it goes to such a great cause. So we've put up the matching fund, but if we don't get the full 25,000, then we don't get the full 50,000 for the right. charity. So please spend our money. This is a good opportunity for you guys to do that. And again, and I can't endorse you guys any more than we have. I mean, that's why we're donating. That's why we're doing the pledge, because you guys have been so good to our horses and so good to the industry. And it's just an opportunity for us to give back, and we can't be happier to write this check.
Oh, well, we really appreciate it. It's really going to help us launch this campaign. It already has. And we really appreciate the support from your family and everything that you guys have done there here at TDN for sure.
So Tuesday is when it's going to get, Giving Tuesday is the important day, November 30th. Is that right?
30th. Yep. So, I mean, technically it'll run till, you know, December 1st, but that's Giving Tuesday is the 30th. And that'll be our big push. Our big final push is on that day.
Well, we want to thank Anna Ford, the program director for New Vocations, so much for being our Green Group guest of the week this week on the TDN Writers Room podcast. Anna, thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
We want to remind you the Green Group guest of the week is sponsored by the Green Group, an accounting and tax consulting advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's guest of the week, Anna Ford will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from the Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes. All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Well, another big week for West Point as they had their 50th win of the season last week with Bear Alley at Churchill Downs on Wednesday. 3-year-old colt by Will Take Charge, won in a photo finish for his trainer, Dale Romans. John, what's new with West Point?
Well, the West Point DJ Stable connection will continue going forward with Turn Decide running this weekend, Thanksgiving Day weekend, at Aqueduct in the Turf Sprint Championship. And that'll be on the 27th. That's a 6-furlong turf race. And then we also have a SWAT analysis that we own with West Point Thoroughbreds. And he is, as we speak, being vanned down to the fairgrounds. He's a Louisiana bred, and he will come back up, you know, in December, running in the Louisiana Championship Day Sprint, going 6 furlongs. So a couple of connections with West Point Thoroughbred. And I think I saw where they announced that they won like their 50th race of the year or something astronomical like that. So we're just glad that we were a part of it. And with a couple of these really great colts that we own with them.
With just a few weeks left to go in the season, West Point runners have earned over $4.1 million. This is the fourth time that West Point has surpassed $4 million in earnings. So congratulations, the West Point partners. But there's still more to come for them this year, including the highly anticipated next start for their star, Flightline, who's pointing for the Grade 1 Malibu on December 26th, and had his most recent work on Monday, going 5 furlongs in 1:20. Getting back to stories that made the news last week, and John, boy, Churchill Downs, they have no shame. they closed down Arlington Park, you know, one of the worst things that's happened in American racing in years, you know, racetrack that everybody just loved in the third largest city in the country, leaving Illinois Racing in shambles. They did it because, as we know, they figured out that they would make more money by having a casino near Arlington without competition from an Arlington casino. So what do? They say, oh, we're still involved in the horse racing business. We want to keep our OTBs. And they make this, that was before the Illinois Racing Board. And they make this whole case about how they care about racing and they're committed to racing. What a bunch of load of crap.
Well, they're a publicly traded company. And if it's surprising to anybody that they're not chasing the last dollar, you know, out there, then shame on you. I'm sure for their shareholders, they appreciate it. You know, they appreciate the fact that they're going to try to do a very simple business analysis. And that's, you know, what are we losing money in? The racetrack. Okay, let's sell it and make a lot of money based on the land values. And then what can we still salvage from this, you know, from the Titanic? Oh, okay, well, we can still get OTB and still, you know, get an income stream from that and not have a big outlay of cash. That's a win-win for the shareholders and for the bottom line. So it doesn't surprise me that they're kind of flip-flopping to their advantage, depending on who the audience is. You know, what surprises me is that it took this long for them to actually calculate it and figure it out, because ultimately these publicly traded companies, they're on a, you know, we think we're on a show by show contract, which is why Joe Bianca is out this week. You know, they're on really on a quarter to quarter contract with regard to making sure that share price stays up.
So let me bounce something off you guys. It's the same topic, sort of. So now you've got the Chicago Bears that own, or they're very soon going to own, if they don't already, the land that Arlington Park sits on in the racetrack itself. It's a hot political topic in Illinois to move the Chicago Bears from Chicago to Arlington Heights. Okay, that politics has got to be navigated. They've got to do site surveys, architectural drawings to get the state. You're talking 4 or 5 years at least before they can really get into the nuts and bolts of starting to build that stadium. I know it's too late, given dates and all that, for 2022, but if I'm the Chicago Bears and I've got a viable racetrack sitting there for 2023, 2024, and I can make money, some money, running races at Arlington Park, why would I not lease Arlington Park to Horsemen or to some other organization? Hell, maybe back to CDI, I don't know. And run races there until I'm actually ready to break ground and start building a stadium. Why couldn't that happen?
I guess it could, Randy. You know, first of all, they hadn't applied for dates in 2022, so that ship has sailed. There's not going to be any racing there. But you know, I guess probably because, and this gets back to one of the reasons why Arlington is closing in the first place, my guess is because it's not profitable. You know, there's no money to be made in there. And, you know, that's one thing people look, I would never side with Churchill Downs on something like this, but I have to keep in mind that, you know, like John said, these are business decisions. And if Arlington Park was a smashing success, making millions and millions of dollars every year for Churchill Downs, it would still be racing. So, but you bring up an interesting point. I know the NFL is something that you're highly involved with as well in your broadcasting career. Have you heard any rumors to that effect that this might be something that, that could happen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there have been longstanding rumors that the Chicago Bears wanted to move from Soldier Field to Arlington Heights. And the infrastructure is a lot better at Arlington Heights. The stadium at Soldier Field is substandard by NFL quality, even after it was renovated. So the Bears have long wanted to move, but it's been just political suicide almost. I mean, when Mayor Daley was in Chicago, I mean, he went to great lengths to try to make sure that that didn't happen. So with Lori Lightfoot there now as the mayor of Chicago, I mean, she's made a little noise. But if the Bears want to get out of their lease, I think they can find a way out. And you know, if it's not too prohibitive financially, then I would expect that that's going to be the end game here.
Wait, there's political unrest and kerfuffles in Chicago?
Imagine that.
Well, good. Speaking of Churchill Downs, many, many big races this weekend. It's the last fling for 2021 before we turn the page and get into 2022 and start talking about the road to the Kentucky Derby or not. And just one race that I think is worth looking at is the Clark Friday at Churchill Downs and $750,000. And I handicapped Saturday's card at Churchill. And the first time I looked at it in a while, I was just astounded. $147,000 allowance races at Churchill. The purses are just through the roof. Grade one purse, $750,000. Midnight Bourbon and Maxfield, who'll be making his last career start before he goes off the stud, will likely be the two favorites in there. John, what do you think about the Clark on Friday?
Well, again, Bill, it just goes to show, you mentioned the purse structure. It goes to show the strength of having Kentucky breds and racing in Kentucky. It's almost like there's a couple of super tracks and then kind of the rest of the field after that. That being said, the Clark, we talk all the time about these grade one races. Are they legitimate grade one? Should they be reclassified next year? This is, I think, a legitimate grade one, save a couple of horses that are really, really long shots, Chess Chief and Militarist that at least in the morning lines look like they don't deserve to be there. There's four or five horses in here that, if they hit the wire first, you wouldn't be surprised. Midnight Bourbon has a legitimate chance after finishing, second in back-to-back grade ones in the Travers and the Pennsylvania Derby. He drew the one hole for Steve Asmussen. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have Maxfield, who, as you mentioned, is going to be finishing up his tidy 11th start of his career and going off and living the life that I think all three of us would like to have after a successful athletic career, and that's going off the stud. So, and then in between you have Dr. Post, for Todd Pletcher, who finished third in the Woodward. Happy Saver, also a Pletcher horse who ran second in the Jockey Club Gold Cup to Max Player, who, Bill, I'm disappointed you didn't even mention that Max Player is going to be horse of the year at the show. And then you have King Fury for Kenny McPeak, who's run, some interesting races. I don't know if he's quite up to speed with these guys in the Clark, but there's a few horses in here that I think are what I would call legitimate. And interestingly enough, I think this is the deepest Clark that I've seen in the past few years, because historically, a lot of the top contenders end up going to the Breeders' Cup Classic or one of the Breeders' Cup races. And a couple of them that we just mentioned actually held back and targeted this specific race, decided not to go out west, and are running in this specific race. The last grade one for handicap horses of the year.
Randy, were you surprised that Maxfield went in this instead of the Breeders' Cup Classic?
A little, Bill, but I think it's almost the same thing that we saw with the Dubai World Cup. I mean, you had Maxfield seemingly on track to go to the Dubai World Cup, and Godolphin also had Mystic Guide, and they opted to send Mystic Guide and keep Maxfield at home. It's as if Godolphin believes that Maxfield is a very good horse, but not a great horse. And they made the same decision, obviously, with the Central Quality in the Breeders' Cup Classic. So, it's a really deep field. I agree. I love this race, but I am very bullish on Midnight Bourbon in this spot. I mean, he gets the weight break for being a 3-year-old. I think he's faster early than Happy Saver. There's not a lot of speed in the race. He draws inside. I think he'll be the controlling early speed. I think it's Midnight Bourbon's race to lose. And Maxfield is drawn on the far outside, and we've seen him lose ground before and run well, but I don't think he can go three wide on the turns and be able to overcome Midnight Bourbon with a loose lead from the inside post. My opinion.
I think that's very legitimate. And Bill, one of the things that you've mentioned on previous shows is again, the jockey change for Midnight Bourbon, going from Santana to Rosario. And you were actually the first one that I would credit that noticed those changes. Steve Asmussen taking Santana off the majority of his top horses, including Midnight Bourbon.
Yeah, I mean, that's something to keep an eye on. Ricardo Santana had a just dreadful fall at Keeneland, and looks like Steve Asmussen is using him less and less. So we'll see how that works out as we go down the pike. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. You think that 50 years of combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program? Give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy wrapped up a fantastic Keeneland November sale with 88% sold, including a weanling filly session topper, the highest priced free drop Billy weanling of the year, and the highest priced Catalina Cruiser of the sale. Congrats to the team at Legacy. And last week I mentioned that Sleepy Eyes Todd, a winner at Fawner Park, is heading to stud at Swifty Farms. And I have to give another shout out to him because he's actually now one of four Legacy grads at stud, along with Gervin, Killy Beg's captain, and Capo Kane. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
Well, that's a wrap on this week's TDN Writers Room. I want to thank Randy Moss for coming in, the sixth man coming in off the bench to fill in for Joe Bianca. We'll be back next week. We want to thank Randy Moss, John Green, our producer, executive producer, Patty Wolf, assistant producer, Katie Ritz Petruniak, and the editors, Nathan Wilkinson, Aaliyah Rocca, and Anthony LaRocca. Bill Finley signing off for the TDN Writers Room. As I mentioned earlier, Joe Bianca will be back next week. Thanks for tuning in and listening.